Roy Eldridge, Vic Dickinson, Lester Young, Teddy Wilson, Gene Ramey and Joe Jones in 1956. I guess I'll have to change my plan. And now, here on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Jazz Lineup with Claire Martin.
Hello. Concert music tonight recorded at this year's Edinburgh Fringe featuring award-winning quartet Brass Jaw. Brass Jaw, and stay tuned for those concert highlights later on in the programme. But to start the show, here's something brand new from the Australian band The Sholin Afronauts, who were a recent hit at this year's Glastonbury Festival with their unique mix of Afrobeat, avant-garde spiritual jazz, inspired by artists such as Sun Ra and Mulatu Astarke. Taken from their 21-track double album, let's hear the title track, Follow the Path. We'll be right back. Afrobeat with a strong, funky undercurrent. That was the very individual sounds of the Sholin Afronauts, who are almost creating a brand new musical genre. And their album, Follow the Path, is out on the Freestyle record label. That comes out on September the 8th. Abstract Forces is the second release from Cloudmakers Trio, the brainchild of award-winning vibes player and percussionist Jim Hart, and features Whirlwind Recordings founder Michael Janisch on double bass and Dave Smith playing the drums. Jim describes the music as definitely highly charged, with a strong rhythmical focus on the one hand, but at the same time celebrating the freedom and openness of improvisation. Well, let's hear all that in action with the track Angular Momentum.
Thank you.
singular momentum taken from the new release from Jim Hart's Cloudmakers trio called Abstract Forces. And you can hear the band at the Albert in Bristol on September the 28th. They play St Ives Jazz Club on the 30th of September. And the London launch for the CD will be at the Crypt on the 3rd of October. Back in 1961, saxophonist Bobby Wellens was inspired to write the Culloden Moor Suite after reading John Preble's vivid account of the last brutal and bloody battle on British soil, which happened on the 16th of April back in 1746. We're 50 years later and Bobby has joined forces with fellow saxophonist Tommy Smith and the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra to recreate and record this thrilling and powerful music. The suite is a five-piece narrative which is Bobby's poignant vision of this Highland tragedy. Let's hear the haunting opening piece, The Gathering. Thank you. Taken from the new release from the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra and National Treasure saxophonist Bobby Wellens, with the Culloden Moor Suite, which is out on the 15th of September on Tommy Smith's label Spartacus Records. Soul-stirring stuff there with the opening piece, The Gathering. 60 years ago, a young girl called Eunice Kathleen Wayman adopted the stage name Nina Simone. A child virtuoso whose piano recitals were local events, Dr. Nina Simone started her musical career as a classically trained pianist and became a singer almost by accident. Well, the rest is history. Her recordings over the next five decades earned her cult status, critical acclaim, and reached the top of the charts on many occasions. Well, in June, Warner Jazz released a 5-CD original album series box set of Nina Simone, and one of the albums featured in the five is the 1962 release of her unique interpretations of Duke Ellington songs. So let's hear her sing Something to Live For.
I want something to live for. Someone who'd make my life an adventurous dream. And make it seem gay, as they say it ought to be. Oh, why can't I have love like that brought to me? My heart. Watching the noon crowd, searching the promenade, seeking a clue. Something to live for, something to live for, something to live for.
Something to Live For, sung by the one and only Nina Simone from her Duke Ellington album, which is included in the new release from Warner Jazz, which combines five of her recordings, and it's out now. Were named Ensemble of the Year at last year's Scottish Jazz Awards, Brush Jaw are a Glasgow-based four-piece who bring a new and exciting sound to the world of jazz. They play without the safety net of a rhythm section and have been described by Jazz UK as funky, intelligent and riotously entertaining. The band are Paul Towndrow on alto sax, Alain Beauvaison on baritone, Michael Owers on trombone and Ryan Quigley on trumpet. and they played at the BBC's pop-up village at Potterow as part of this year's Edinburgh Festival Fringe on the 18th of August. Let's hear them now as they open with Charles Franklin Blues.
Thank you.
Brass Jaw with The Stinger, recorded at the BBC's pop-up village at Potterow as part of this year's Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and that was recorded on August the 18th. Brass Jaw are Paul Townsend on alto saxophone, Alain Beauvaison on baritone, Michael Owers on trombone and Ryan Quigley on trumpet. This is Jazz Lineup on BBC Radio 3 with me, Claire Martin, on FM, online and on digital radio. On a recent trip to the Brecon Jazz Festival, Jazz Lineup were lucky enough to catch the wonderful performance by pianist John Taylor at Brecon Cathedral. The interplay between his bandmates, bassist Pally Danielson and drummer Martin France, was sensitive, telepathic and full of surprises and colours. Featuring the same stellar lineup from their 2005 album Angel of the Presence, this is their interpretation of Kenny Wheeler's Intro to No Particular Song.
Thank you.
taken from the album Angel of the Presence. That was Intro to No Particular Song by John Taylor. And John is just one of the artists performing at this year's Hearts Jazz Festival. He'll be performing there in a quartet setting on the Saturday night, that's the 13th of September, at the Hawthorne Theatre in Welwyn Garden City. For more details on that festival, which runs from September the 12th to the 14th, and also features artists including Art Thiemann and James Pearson's trio, and the festival organisers Clark Tracy's quintet, check out the link on Jazz Lineup's webpage via the Radio 3 website. We're staying with piano, but something very different now, this time in the hands of Swiss pianist Nick Birch. He draws on a wide range of influences, including John Cage, Béla Bartók and Chick Corea. This is his minimal hypnotic style. Nick is playing piano and percussion on Modal 6. Modal 6 by Swiss pianist Nick Birch from his album called Hishirio. And if you enjoyed that, it's worth seeking out Nick's work with his Zen funk group called Ronin and his recordings on the iconic ECM label. Ollie Howell is a British drummer who's been endorsed by jazz giant Quincy Jones and has also been taken under the wing of the legendary jazz drummer Jimmy Cobb, who played on the Kinda Blue album with Miles Davis. And he said he's loaded with talent. Let's hear a track from his debut CD, Sutures and Stitches, which features Mark Perry on the trumpet, Duncan Eagles playing the saxophone, bassist Mark Luthert, and pianist Matt Robinson. This is Later On.
Thank you.
That was drummer Ollie Howell with Later On, taken from his CD Sutures and Stitches. And Ollie will be playing at WM Jazz Club at the O2 in London, followed by a string of dates in Scotland, including Carnegie Hall in Dunfermline on September the 17th, the Blue Lamp in Aberdeen on the 18th, and the Jazz Bar in Edinburgh on the 21st. You can also hear him at this year's Scarborough Jazz Festival on the 26th of September. And for more information on Ollie, check out the link on the Jazz Lineup webpage via the Radio 3 website. Can it really be 16 years ago since pianist Brad Meldo recorded Songs, The Art of the Trio, Volume 3? I remember I couldn't wait to get this particular volume, as he'd covered not only a very popular Radiohead song, but also Riverman, perhaps folk legend Nick Drake's most famous song and one of my all-time favourites. Let's hear Brad's interpretation with Larry Grenadier on bass and Georges Rosset on the drums.
Thank you.
Brad Meldo on piano with his interpretation of Nick Drake's Riverman, and that's taken from Brad Meldo's songs, The Art of the Trio, Volume 3, with Larry Grenadier on bass and George Rossi on the drums. Well, that's almost the end of this week's jazz lineup, but there's plenty more jazz on BBC Radio 3 with Geoffrey Smith's Jazz Tonight at midnight, and Jazz on 3 on Monday nights at 11. And this week, Jez Nelson presents prog jazz outfit Lead Beer Bin Concert at the Vortex Club in London, celebrating the band's 10th anniversary. And on next week's jazz lineup, the second instalment of a concert set from the big Chris Barber Band, recorded at this year's Brecon Jazz Festival. Plus, Kevin Ajamra will be here to unearth another classic album of recent times in our regular monthly feature, Now's the Time. But that's nearly it for tonight's show. Let's close with a piece by the great American pianist Bruce Bath, who was recently gracing our shores when he played some London dates with vocalist René Marie. This is from his new release called Daybreak, and it's Jobim's Triste. From me, Claire Martin, until next time. Bye-bye.
was Triste, performed by Bruce Bath, ending this week's jazz lineup. The programme is produced in Glasgow by Sushil K. Dade.
The BBC asks thousands of questions every day. Is rocket science easier than you think? Would we starve without honeybees? And how did so many soldiers survive the trenches? But what if we want to know more? BBC I Wonder asks intriguing questions and reveals thought-provoking answers. As one question is answered, another is raised. The discoveries are endless. BBC I Wonder. Go to bbc.co.uk/iWonder.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 7:10 and time to go to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, which is presented by Donald MacLeod.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where we're celebrating Strauss 150 in the first of two operatic nights this weekend at the BBC Proms. In 20 minutes' time, the capacity audience here will be bracing themselves, if they're not already, for the impact of one of opera's most intense experiences, the full-on visceral force of Richard Strauss's telling of the biblical story of Salome, the teenage girl who, as her reward for performing the wildly sensuous dance of the Seven Veils, demands the head of John the Baptist. Strauss has taken over the Albert Hall this weekend. Tomorrow night, Christina Gerke will sing the title role in his ferociously powerful retelling of the Greek myth of Electra. Well, tonight, taking centre stage, it's the Swedish soprano Nina Stemmer, who's taking the world's opera houses by storm in the title role, and we'll be hearing her as Salome, with the forces of the Deutsche Oper Berlin making their debut at the Proms with their music director, Donald Ronicles. He thinks the way we're experiencing the opera tonight has a lot to recommend it.
I think there's a very good case to be made for seeing it, literally seeing it in concert, because the orchestra plays this phenomenal part in not just in bringing all the colours of the Orient or giving us this luscious, slightly depraved, decadent world through sound, but when you actually see the orchestra on stage with the singers and you see how much give and take there is between both of them, I think it's in some ways an even more visceral experience musically.
The conductor, Donald Ronicles. Well, this is the first time Strauss's Salome has been heard complete at the Proms, but before we hear it, we've tonight's Proms Plus, which took place across the road in the Royal College of Music about an hour ago. It's introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Joining me to talk about Strauss's groundbreaking opera Salome are Hugo Shirley, music writer and Strauss specialist, and Fiona Maddox, the Observer's classical music critic. Welcome to you both. Hugo, can you start by positioning Salome for us in the whole of Strauss's operatic output?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think often happens with Salome is because it was such a breakthrough for Strauss, those early two operas, which were Guntram in the early 1890s and Feuersnot, premiered in 1901, get sort of forgotten, but they actually kind of lead to Salome in a very important way. And then, of course, in 1905, we have Salome premiered, an enormous success in Dresden, and then it sort of spread across the musical world as far as was allowable, given that the censors tended to have objections to its content. And that paved the way for Electra, which we're obviously hearing tomorrow, then Rosenkavalier, Ariadne, Die Frauenschatten, which takes us up to the 1920s, and then Intermezzo and Arabella, which is the final work with Hugo von Hofmannsthal, who is the librettist for Electra. A few more, which we won't go into. Finally, we get to Capriccio towards the very end of his life, which is the sort of summing up of his career as an opera composer.
Fiona, tend to actually talk about the inspiration for this, because it comes from Oscar Wilde's Salome. First of all, why was the subject of Salome such a big deal, this biblical figure? Why was she so important to the sort of late 19th century and early 20th century audience?
Well, she was important for about 2,000 years before that, but, you know, we won't go into every one of those episodes in which she appeared, you'll be relieved to know. In the mid-late 19th century, particularly in France, bearing in mind that Wilde spent a lot of time in Paris, The whole subject of Salome caught fire. Wilde was not the first, he was not the last. Apparently there were about 1,000 very bad, I imagine, poems in French about the subject of Salome. But why? Why? I guess because it's a pretty saucy subject. Here is a young girl dancing for her stepfather, and then, probably at the behest of her mother, but maybe by the time we get to Strauss, out of her own desire, asking as a reward for doing her dance to her stepfather for the head of the prophet John the Baptist, who just happens to be down in the cistern and is available and happens to be rather attractive. And she's, because he's a prophet, he's not really available for Salome's kisses. So she goes the only way she can and asks for his head.
And what of those two aspects of Salome's story were more sensational for that audience, the beheading of John the Baptist or the dance that she does for her stepfather?
Well, the dance, although it was always there, and it was there in the biblical telling, which is very short, by the time Wilde got hold of it, it had become a sort of fantasy subject. And in fact, he invented the Dance of the Seven Veils, so they don't mention that in the Bible. And his play really exposes the sort of rampant sexuality of the subject. I think the whole thing is pretty shocking, actually. It's really shocking. Prepare to be shocked.
And it was, I mean, Wilde's play was banned in England.
It was. It had to be done in Paris, where they prefer that sort of thing, apparently.
Specifically, why was it banned in England? Was it because of the sexual content?
It was because you couldn't put the Bible on the stage, essentially. It wasn't really because of the sexual content. It was because it was blasphemous.
So why did Strauss turn to Oscar Wilde and Hugo?
Well, Strauss's critics tend to argue that he saw that this was a subject that he could make a lot of money with. It was extremely popular and sensational, and he could ride that wave and swell his bank balance as a result. I think that's probably a little bit unfair, and particularly when you do view it in the context of his other works, where right from Don Juan in 1888, he'd been exploring the possibilities of this amazing sensuality and sexuality on in music, and with Feuersnot, which isn't very well known, but his opera before Salome, he kind of throws away the Wagnerian shackles. With Wagner's operas, there'd been a fair amount of sex and sensuality, obviously, but it'd always been associated with some sort of lofty philosophical ideal. It never really existed for its own sake. Whereas in Feuersnot, he ends up by celebrating sex, essentially, with this joyous conclusion, with this girl saving a town by basically giving up her virginity and sort of enjoying it in the process. And once we see Salome within that context, we can see that it is actually a further exploration of the possibilities that there were with music and with opera if you stopped worrying about the idea that that music should necessarily be edifying and kind of have some sort of, yeah, and actually also about the kind of uncoupling, the final uncoupling of music from religion as well, and this kind of idea that it should be reaching towards God in some sort of way, whether that's a secular God or a divine God.
The interesting thing is that Strauss saw, and the play, Wilde's play was very popular immediately, funnily enough. Why is it that sexy subjects that are banned seem to appeal to a lot of people? It got very good publicity as a result and was translated instantly. And Strauss saw it in Berlin in about 1903 in a little theatre upstairs above a hotel, no longer in existence, a hotel theatre. And Max Reinhardt had produced the play, And Strauss was pretty riveted, and on his way out, one of his friends said to him, "You know, Strauss, you really ought to do this as an opera." And he said, "I've already started work on it." So he no hesitation there, no struggle with a librettist. He just took the play pretty much wholesale in a German translation.
Yeah, because he'd actually been approached by a poet who had sent him a few kind of versified lines of a Zalame libretto. But interestingly, if we're talking about the whole kind of French literary situation, the only real opera that can be comparable in how it was produced by setting a play as it was is Pelléas and Mélisande, which the play is by Maeterlinck, set by Debussy. And